In what churches or other religious organizations have you participated?
Over my lifetime or as a clergy person?
Pretty much anything.
Anything?
Yeah.
Okay. I grew up in Dodge City, was a member of the United Methodist Church there before it was the United Methodist mm-hmm. Church was just the Methodist Church. And then married my wife, who is Roman Catholic. Oh. And so we have an ecumenical mm-hmm. home, I guess, mm-hmm. is a good way to put that. We attended the Catholic Church for a number of years after we were married, mm-hmm. and then because my wife didn't agree with the teachings of the church on especially on contraception and that sort of thing, we moved to the Episcopal Church mm-hmm. in Dodge City. We were at St. Cornelius there for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. So my oldest two children. My oldest son is 34 and my middle daughter is 32. They were born in Garden City and baptized in the Roman Catholic mm-hmm. faith tradition. Our son, Rob, who's our middle son and is about 30 now, he's 29, 30.
Yeah.
And he was baptized in the Anglican or Episcopal Church in Dodge St. Cornelius. It was about that time that we were moved by the need of the church. The church was in decline, the church that I grew up in, and my parents were both attending there, and so we went back to the Methodist Church as laypersons. Mm-hmm. I was working in the insurance business at that time, and before that in the car business, and so I'd had a call in that church when I was 14 to become what I am today,
mm-hmm.
and I ran from that call, which is pretty much what the call thought said I would do. So anyway, long story short, we started going to the First United Methodist Church in Dodge City. My job, I got a promotion in the insurance business that I was manager of, and we moved to Hutchinson and became members of the South Hutch United Methodist mm-hmm. Church, and it was from that church that I answered my call into ministry
mm-hmm.
as second career, and attended a Disciple of Christ Christian Church seminary in Enid, Oklahoma, and then the seminary moved to Tulsa, Oklahoma. So I spent 2 years going to Enid and 2 years going to Tulsa. And so I learned a little bit about the Stone Campbell movement of the Christian Church. And so that's a little of my history.
Mm-hmm.
I was ordained as a United Methodist elder in 2000 and continue to be that. That's part of a religious order that really governs who we are, and then we agree to itinerate, which means it's kind of a fancy word that means the bishop tells us where to go and live and be a pastor.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little of my ecumenism of the things that.
Mm-hmm.
That I've experienced as far as my upbringing mm-hmm. within the church, but basically I'm a United Methodist. It's a long story, a long answer for a short question.
Can you tell us anything about the founding and early days of the organization?
Of United Methodism?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can. It began as a movement within the Anglican Church. And I will try to give you as short an answer as I can.
Because, it's really okay.
but John Wesley was part of the Anglican Church. He was one of the greats, the great minds of the 18th century, and was born in the early 1700s in England. His father was an Anglican priest. Or pastor, and his mother Susanna was a brilliant woman, really ahead of her time, and really one who would fit in very well today. but back in the early 1700s, she had a lot of conflicts that she was able to maneuver very well. But she, I think she had 19 children. John was one of the younger to middle ones. Mm-hmm. And he was very, very intelligent. She taught all of the children, especially John and his brother Charles, Latin, Greek, Hebrew, the mathematic disciplines. So she was very well educated and taught her children. John went on to Oxford, England, or Oxford University in England, and he, it's my understanding, in the Great Hall, the Great Dining Hall, there are all of the great English leaders of that era. There's only one that was a religion major, and that's John Wesley. Mm-hmm. And so he was thought of very highly, even though when he started Methodism, he really did it with a very, very strict discipline, and he had what was really put down as a holy club first. He would he and a group of small group of people would gather every day, and they would pray, and then they would go out and do service work, and they would study scriptures and do their studies, but they would take care of widows and orphans, who that was a real problem back then. They didn't have the social networks that we have, and so they would make sure that those folks were cared for as best they could. And they would also go into the prisons. And it was that time in those prisons, if you didn't have someone on the outside who could take care of you, then you just languished and died. They wouldn't provide food or water or anything. It was very important that they did the mandate from Matthew 25:35, and so, which is, of course, you know, for I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. A stranger and you welcomed me in prison and you visited me, so on and so forth. But anyway, John Wesley began that as a movement within the Anglican Church. The Anglican Church is different than what we experience in America, and because of that, he felt that the common folk, the church should be open to the common folk, and it wasn't at that time. Unless you were part of the wealthy, the aristocracy, or royalty, or you really weren't taught the love of God and the good news of Jesus Christ. Wesley changed that, and because of that, he caused a big stir. And so he was told that he would not have a pulpit. In other words, he would be put on leave, as it were. And his response is a famous one now. He responded, "The world is my parish." And so he went out, and Methodism started growing by leaps and bounds in England. He would preach to those who were working in the coal mines and those in the dank bars and brothels that the coal miners would walk home, and what would happen would be they would get paid at their job and walk home and pass these, and many of them would spend all their money, and they would have nothing for their wives and children when they got home. So he saw that as a real need, and children were not being educated. They were going to work in the coal mines when they were 7, 8 years old, and that was horrible work, and they were dying at early ages because of the black lung disease. So he started working there, and they would preach in great open areas, commons, and they might preach to 4,000 or 5,000 people, which, you know, they have these pictures of these carts, anyway, that they would, preaching carts, they would call them. And so it started to become a pretty big deal. Wesley did come over to the United States, or not what is now the United States, the colony of Georgia at that time, and he was here to convert the Native Americans, and he was riding that high of all he had done in England, and was sure that he he would come over, and he came over, and it was a dismal failure. To make matters worse, there was a sheriff in Georgia who had a beautiful daughter that they had a kind of a mutual thing, and then they broke up, and it got real nasty, and so there was a bounty put on his head.
Oh, no.
And so he came back to England, and uh-huh. He was just total shambles.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm loath to remember the year now, 1738, I believe. Might be 1728. I'd have to look that up.
Mm-hmm.
He was really just trying to decide what he's going to do with his life at this point. Maybe go back to Oxford and become a doctor, lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
He could do a lot of different things, politician. But he was languishing at home, and Peter Bowler, who was part of the Moravian Christians, and he met him on the ship going over to America, came and visited him and saw that he was in just dismal shape, and invited him to a society. They called them, by this time Methodism had developed into societies where they mm-hmm. would go and meet outside the church, but they would meet and they would read the scriptures mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. A lot of people couldn't read at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they didn't have iPods then, so
yeah.
podcasts. So.
Yeah.
But anyway, they were able to get John Wesley to go to this society meeting, and it was during the time of the reading of the Book of Romans, the Epistle Romans, that he felt his heart strangely warmed, and that's a really, if you're a Methodist, those words are very, he felt his heart strangely warmed, and that his sins, even his, were forgiven, and that he could go out into the world without fear
mm-hmm.
and preach the good news, and God would care for him. And from that time on, that was kind of his, his moment of change and inspiration mm-hmm. where he had been challenged to the nth degree and personally, and then
mm-hmm.
and then he came back, and so it was that Aldersgate experience, mm-hmm. Aldersgate Street experience that is very, very famous in Methodism,
mm-hmm.
and really part of who we are as God's people. And so it continued to grow, and the societies continued. It was always part of the Anglican Church, but kind of an uncomfortable alliance within the hierarchy of the mm-hmm. church, but they did have lay people that were really active, and I'm trying to think if there's something like it today, and there's really not anything that I can compare it exactly to, but it was very much a disciplined life. There were accountability groups that met, these small groups that would meet, and every week, sometimes every day, depending on the group. And they would study scripture, and then they would confess their sins to each other, which is really hard.
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
you know, had all this,
yeah.
I did this, I said that, and then they would be given forgiveness and acceptance, and then move on with their lives. And they did that on a regular basis, and then they would meet, the smaller groups would then meet as these societies, on a regular basis, once a month or something, mm-hmm. once a week sometimes, depending on the society and depending on the small group. Long story short, then Methodism continued to grow. It grew then across the sea as people were leaving England to come here. And they sent originally lay people who were unordained and,
mm-hmm.
and not approved by the church to help start these societies and these different groups. And so every time on the frontier or as in the colonies, the churches would be formed, these groups would be formed, and they were always part of the Anglican Church. And every once in a while, the Anglican priests would come around and they would administer the sacraments of communion
mm-hmm.
and baptism and,
mm-hmm.
and that sort of thing, because these lay people that were really in charge couldn't do that due to church law. Then the little thing called the Revolutionary War happened. Wesley took the side of England. He was very much a Tory, and but Francis Asbury, who was his main emissary at that time in the colonies, stayed. But all of the clergy were pulled out. So all during the Revolutionary War, the societies met, but they couldn't have communion. They couldn't have, there were no baptisms, no marriage. I mean, they couldn't be married, and all that stuff the church does, except for the meeting and really the important spiritual development part. So Francis Asbury stayed during the entire Revolutionary War, which was not an easy thing for him, because there were people in on this side of the excuse me just a minute.
Good morning.
Asbury stayed over here at great peril to his own life, because there were colonists who thought he was from England. He was part of the established church, and so therefore he was the enemy. So he had to hide out with people who knew him well enough in Methodist circles, so they wouldn't kill him, basically was what it was. And he survived all that, stayed here. He was the only Anglican clergy that did, that we know of. And so when the war was over, he said, okay, you know, we're going to form a church. This is ridiculous. John Wesley was one of those really single-minded people that didn't change his mind, and he was in his late 70s at this time. Really an interesting fellow with a lot of grace, and did a lot of good things for lots and lots of people. I could tell you a lot more about that. He established schools for children in England, that where there were no schools, really gave us the foundation for public schools today. Colleges, we have hundreds and hundreds of United Methodist colleges that are established because of his commitment to education. Anyway, all that happened while he was alive. And there are wonderful tales that I can tell you, but these are just the basics. Asbury came back, got into it with Wesley over separating out the American church as a church and not a movement within the Anglican church. He said, you won't get anybody over there because right now they hate everything English. You know, they hate they hate the Queen or the King, you're our enemies, and so, or you're their enemies. And so he convinced John Wesley, which was really something of a miracle, because once Wesley had made up his mind, which was to never have Methodism anything but a part of the Anglican church, it separated at that point. And you know, basically Asbury told him, you know, I'll either do this on my own or with your blessings, your call. And he said, okay, with my blessings. So they wrote up a constitution. He sent with this great crate of hymnals and disciplines. The Book of Discipline is our guideline that we live by as far as the church, and also some Bibles and commentaries that he had written for preaching. And then in 1784, they had the first conference, which in Baltimore, it's called the Christmas Conference, and it happened during the Christmas season, and that was when they established the church. Francis Asbury and Thomas Coke were the two that were sent over then to start this new denomination called Methodists. And it was one of those moments that really changed the face of America, or helped shape it, is a better way to say that, maybe, because the Methodists were organized with circuit riders who would go out and as the frontier grew, they would establish circuits where every time there was a little town that popped up or a community, they would they would say, I'll come and preach on Tuesday at about this time. Ring the bell, and the community bell, and everybody drops what they're doing and comes in. And that's how so many Methodist churches were established. And as the frontier moved west, Methodism moved right with them while still upholding that. So anyway, the Methodism was very, very strong, and it grew tremendously during those early years of the late 1700s and into the 1800s. It moved right on out here. It moved to Kansas, if you're interested in Kansas history, as early as 1830. In the Shawnee Mission area. I think that's right. I'm trying to think. It was Good was his last name. That was the one that was commissioned to come here. Alexander H. Good, I think. I'm committed to memory on that, and it's not always accurate, so you may want to check that out. But he came out in early on, and started establishing, again with the Native Americans out here, some Methodist schools and all of that. And there were others that would follow. And so as Kansas grew into, first it was a territory and then into a state, wherever there were people that the frontier grew into, churches would be formed by these circuit riding preachers, and they really put their own lives on the line. It was said that that the lifespan of a Methodist preacher averaged 2 years.
Oh my gosh!
It was because they were constantly on the move. They traveled on horseback in all kinds of weather, in communities that sometimes were dangerous. And there were many that were killed. Somebody you need to hear about, or I love to tell about. You don't need to hear about, maybe, but I love to tell about him. His name is Peter Cartwright, a Methodist circuit riding preacher. He was mostly in Kentucky, Tennessee, in that area as the frontier moved west, but he was this big, burly, mean guy. And what he would do to start a Methodist church, anytime there'd be these little settlements that would, and they always started with a bar, with a place that you could, community store, a place you can buy, rum or beer or whatever. So they, all these old codgers that were rough, tough frontiers would be hanging out there. And so he would come in and he would say, he would ask the bartender, who is the toughest, meanest SOB you got in the saloon here? And he'd point out some guy, and he'd go over and he'd say, I'm Peter Cartwright, and I understand you're the meanest SOB in this group. And he would challenge him to a fight.
Oh my God.
He'd say, and he would always win in these, in the nastiest circumstances. And so he would get up and he would say, and that's what's going to happen to the rest of you if you don't come to my... And I will beat the devil out of you.
Yeah.
And so they came. But that's the way he would just come in and just cold cock the baddest guy in town and then bring people to church.
We have interesting way to get people to come to church.
Not many Methodists do that anymore. Although some of us would need a little more training, I think.
Definitely.
So anyway, but that was Peter Cartwright, and it was in that same era. Kansas, there's that Kansas Missouri thing. Methodists were abolitionists. John Wesley was an abolitionist when it wasn't popular to be an abolitionist. I mean, he really was against slavery, and so what happened was there were splits in the Methodist Church, as there are in a lot of faith mm-hmm. traditions. But the first split came, we'll take a step back, and the first split came when there was a group of Methodists, they called it the Methodist Episcopal Church, when a group of Methodists formed, clergy formed the Methodist Protestant Church. Mm. The reason is they didn't want to itinerate. They didn't want to have the bishop say, mm-hmm. you know, this is your church, and, mm-hmm. you know, they wanted to establish families and syncretes and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. So the Methodist Protestant Church was born in the early 1800s, and it functioned as a smaller faith tradition as the Methodist Episcopal Church grew mm-hmm. by leaps and bounds, all under the Episcopal itinerant system. And then the war, the Civil War, mm-hmm. Happened, mm-hm. and there were the church split along with the country. Mm-hmm. So we have the Methodist Church, Methodist Episcopal Church North, Methodist Episcopal Church South. Mm-hmm. And that churches were formed that were, you know, they weren't the same at all. I mean, they weren't the same. Of course, mm-hmm. all the South had the, you know, the beliefs of slavery is okay. Mm-hmm. North didn't. Mm-hmm. And of course, had the beliefs of the more what we have today. Mm-hmm. And so, what happened at the end of the war, the churches remained split. And it was interesting because it was, I think, 1928. They got together and tried to get the North, the South, and the Methodist Protestants together mm-hmm. as one mm-hmm. to form the Methodist Episcopal Church again. And it was not going well at all. And it took a couple of years, but it was the Methodist Protestants that were that mediary group that was able to work between the two larger mm-hmm. groups to bring the Methodist Church back together. What's this, 50 more or more years mm-hmm. after the Civil War. So you have that kind of thing. It took the church longer to heal. Mm-hmm. And today, in places like Tulsa, and I went to a seminary in Tulsa, mm-hmm. so I know about these things firsthand. They have two huge churches, United Methodist, mm-hmm. about a block apart, downtown Tulsa. One is from the Methodist Church North, one is from the Methodist Church South. And now we're all together, but mm-hmm. they're both huge churches, a block apart, and so as the church continued to grow. Something that we Methodists are basically anti-drinking, mm-hmm. and so that's one of our things. We were head of kind of the Carry Nation movement that mm-hmm. brought that about, and anyway, that all happened. I don't think it was a good thing. It ended up, we can't legislate morality is what, in my opinion, is mm-hmm. what we found out. But it was probably a good attempt. And there were mm-hmm. Alcohol is a really bad drug, mm-hmm. and can really affect people and families very, very negatively. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of abuse, both wife and her spouse, and child abuse, and you know, it was really tough. Mm-hmm. So we're against that. We're part of the women's movement, part mm-hmm. of the civil rights movement. So as America grew, and all those social changes that happened from 1920 to well, really 1960s, 70s, 80s, even. We were in the 90s when, with the women's mm-hmm. movement, mm-hmm. We were really at the forefront of that. And so that's a little bit of who we are, mm-hmm. And historically as the church. In 1968, when this is important, we ceased becoming the Methodist Episcopal Church. The we joined together with the Evangelical United Brethren Church. And they were a much smaller group. And you know how I said that there were two big Methodist churches a block apart? In many, many, many communities, in Kansas especially, there are churches that, United Methodist churches now, that are just a few blocks apart. Here in Salina, University Church is here, and if you go three blocks west of us, you run right into Church of the Cross, another United Methodist church, but a former EUB church, Evangelical United Brethren Church. And so when that happened, in a little town like of Hoisington, I don't know if you know, you know Hoisington, you probably played them in football or something, and or volleyball. And Hoisington has two Methodist churches that are just a block or two apart. Little community, but one is from the EUB tradition, one is from the Methodist Episcopal tradition.
So Marion has two in Eastmore.
That's right.
I forgot. Eastmore's a brethren, and I'm not for sure if Valley is or not, but we do have two.
I should have connected that. But that's a perfect example, right in your hometown. So we have those kind of things that, you know, in 1968 happened. And, you know, and so that formed at that time the United Methodist Church. And I remember all that. I mean, I lived through all that. I was young at the time. I was in my teens. But that was part of the deal. So anyway, historically, the church has grown. Now, in 1950s and 60s, we were at membership and attendance-wise, we were at our high point. And then when the 60s hit and all the institutions took a shot, we did too, and we've not recovered from that. Like most mainline churches, we are reducing in our size and scope. However, Kansas West Conference, I'm a member of that conference, and the general church is composed of conferences that clergy are members of and churches are members of. And the Kansas West Conference has, I think around 88,000 members.
Wow.
And so there's a lot. You know, so it still has a strong impact, but that's a huge decline from where we were. We were about twice that, so we're looking for ways to grow the church, and that's been part of my ministry as I've come here and helped revitalize and been involved in church growth and that sort of thing. So that's a long answer to a short question again. But
that's all right.
But
when did we? Because I'm a Methodist as well.
I thought you.
Yeah. When did we split from the Brethren, Evangelical Brethren?
We have not.
We have not. Okay, it's just
the United, the Evangelical United Brethren. Merged with the Methodist Episcopal to form the United Methodist Church.
Okay.
We took the United from Evangelical United Brethren and the Methodist from and merged.
Okay.
So there was never a split.
Okay.
And now there are different. I mean, there's when you merge even two different churches and stuff, but two different denominations. Way tough. So there's been some, you know, there's been some grief, and it's been a hard thing. The Methodists were a lot larger than the Evangelical United Brethren's church numerically, and so it, you know, it felt like, you know, a corporate takeover almost by some. But overall, I think it's been very good for the EUB faith tradition. We honor that greatly. And let's see, Otterbein was one of the earlier founders of the EU, or maybe the Church of the Brethren. And that's, you know, that's part of the history that that comes as the Brethren came up and the Church of the Brethren came up. That's part of the really neat history.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't take the time to tell you about that branch that came up.
That's all right. I've always wondered, because, I mean, Eastmore used to, Grandma said it used to have the kind of the Brethren name in it, I guess, and then now it's just Eastmore United Methodist Church in Marion, so I don't know.
And what a lot of the churches have done is, you know, they've kind of dropped that off after a certain period of time because the names get too long.
Mm-hmm.
And just from a practical standpoint, University United Methodist Church is a lot to write when you've got a limited number of space and you're, you know, when you type it online or something, it's like, oh boy.
Yeah.
so, you know, sometimes just from that practical aspect, but we really do try to, try to honor that faith tradition and that part of the tradition. In my own family's personal history, my great-great-grandfather homesteaded initially in Lincoln County, in Lincoln, Kansas.
Okay.
And he played Santa Claus back in the 1890s, or 1880s, maybe even, when they homesteaded it out there for the Evangelical Brethren Church, I think it was the EBs, and not the EUBs. Mm-hmm. I think it was prior to that. Mm-hmm. So anyway, he was part of my family was part of that faith tradition a long, long time ago. So. You know, so we do honor that in a lot of different ways, and it had more of a German background, and rather than being English speaking, it was German speaking, and that's a real hindrance to to Wesleyan spread. Mm-hmm. They set it up kind of the way Wesleyan had and used the Wesleyan doctrine, but when you can't communicate, when you have it's like the Hispanic churches now, and we're working on evangelizing in those communities, and really starting to grow Hispanic churches. I know about this much Spanish. I mean, a real small amount, and poquito, and español. So I'm not effective, except that I can work with bilingual Hispanics and help them in the process. And we have a Spanish-speaking service here. Right. And I have a Dr. Antonio Marcella, who is from Argentina, who is our Hispanic pastor. And so he has a small group of Hispanics that meet, and they worship in the Hispanic style and in Spanish. And then we come together on special occasions, or at least monthly, as the church, and everybody worships together. But it is a little difficult for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway,
that's really cool.
That's been a problem.
Yeah.
You know, that was the problem early on with when Coke and Asbury, early on, when after the Revolutionary War, they met at the Christmas conference with German-speaking Methodists, and went off and formed another German faith tradition based on Methodism. But they couldn't make it work, because how can you send an English-speaking preacher into a German community?
Mm-hmm.
And just an interesting side note, I helped to start a little church in Bueller. You've heard of Bueller, probably. Mm-hmm. That's a Mennonite community. Mm-hmm. And the only churches in town were Mennonite churches. And they were German Mennonite, of course. When I went there, I got to talk to a lot of the locals, and they were still a little bit standoffish about this Methodist group that was coming in. But they were telling me that in the mid to late 1970s, the, the predominant language spoken on Main Street in Bueller was German in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. So it's like, wow, this is mm-hmm. really, you know, this is, and I would, you know, could, it was easily spoken, and I don't speak German either, which is, but everybody spoke English. And mm-hmm. I have an idea that the Hispanic situation will kind of come to that as mm-hmm. well. That, you know, there will be those who that will be able to retain their mm-hmm. Spanish speaking, but also learn English. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that's going to be the way it'll end up. But we do have to go in and offer the good news of mm-hmm. Jesus Christ to them.
Definitely. So. Why were people attracted to this religious body?
They, for many reasons. One was it gave a sense of order to their lives and a sense of connectedness with God.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 1800s, because preachers would go out and scare the hell out of
mm-hmm.
them.
Literally.
They would. And mm-hmm. it was a fire and brimstone kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, you make the choice. You either get on board with us today, or mm-hmm. you know, you're on the fiery, you're slippery slope to the fiery mm-hmm. furnace. And they really would. They would have camp meetings where they would, you know, how we take vacations and go mm-hmm. out and camp out. Well, they would have these camp meetings that would last a week or more, and 24 hours a day for that whole week, they would have preachers come in and preach this kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
and people would just, you know, that. And they would be converted and get involved in these small groups, and it would become a part of the fabric of their lives. So it really grew during that time. We don't do that anymore mm-hmm. because theologically that's, you know, that's not who we are.
Mm-hmm.
We are grace-bound people,
mm-hmm.
and we really preach and teach what grace is about, and not living in joy and faith rather than, you know, the trembling and fear.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really who we are today. We have a large contingent of people who are unaffiliated with any faith tradition now here in the church or in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So our mission field really is, you know, the folks around my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's who we, you know, that's who we're trying to attract today. Although the fastest growing area of the church now is in Africa. United Methodist Church is growing fastest in Africa. We are part of a conference that is connecting with Zimbabwe.
Hmm.
And the Bishop of Zimbabwe was actually here in this church preaching a few months ago.
Cool.
And we had annual conference here, and so we're looking at partnering, first of all, conference to conference, then mm-hmm. District to district, which were broken down into different districts, and then church to church, clergy person to clergy person, and individual to individual through prayer and other ways of support that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a great spirit that they bring back to us, and have that. They have nothing compared to what we have as far as material
mm-hmm.
things.
Mm-hmm.
The bishop came in here, and I think of this as being kind of a medium-sized church, and I'm real proud of it, but
mm-hmm.
it's not, you know, not that grand and
yeah.
glorious like some. He was just awestruck. You know, he said, you have so much here. You know, our people, we can build church walls
mm-hmm.
because we make our bricks out of mud.
Mm-hmm.
But we have no money for roofs, so they
mm-hmm.
so they have 400 or 500 come to these places,
mm-hmm.
rain or shine, and they have preachers that preach and they sing and, you know, in the traditional ways, and it's just an amazing experience. But no roofs oftentimes, and they have to be careful. If they put windows in,
mm-hmm.
They'll get stolen.
Because yeah.
So they have, you know, they have to really, really mm-hmm. be careful. But it's an interesting world. But I would encourage you to get on board with that as mm-hmm. a United Methodist and go to Zimbabwe. You could go with the bishop in August.
That would be cool.
That would be. That might change your life.
Yeah. What were daily experiences in the religious body like?
In what context?
Just, I mean, really anything, like interacting with the public or...
You mean today?
Yeah.
Or, okay. Today, we do a number of things. Here locally, every local church has its own mission. We support the general mission of the church through our portion giving. And that, you know, anytime there's a flood or famine or tornado or whether it's in your own backyard or around the globe, United Methodists are generally there to help through our UMCOR, United Methodist Committee on Relief. But we also do much in our local setting. And, for example, this church started the Salina, it started the food pantry, which grew out of the church. It got so big. And now is a major operation that's on the northwest side of Salina. We also work with the Salvation Army real closely. At one time, not too long ago, probably a decade ago, every member of the board was a member of this church. So we do those kinds of things. Our mission here is to serve Christ, campus, and community. And so we do all of the missional stuff that most local churches do, but our affiliation is with Kansas Wesleyan. And I would be loath in my duties to, and I serve as the campus chaplain. So I get to stand on the sidelines with the football team, and do the invocations and all their stuff, and get invited to a lot of wonderful dinners and that sort of
thing. Yeah.
All the pomp and circumstance.
Yeah.
I'm the guy. So anyway, we have a real close connection. 101 years ago, Kansas Wesleyan, actually 125 years ago, Kansas Wesleyan was founded, United Methodist, or Methodist at that Episcopal College at that time, was a mile and a half out of town. We were out in the country at that time. And in 101 years ago, they got tired of walking in, the students, faculty, and administration, walking or riding a horse or buggy into First Church in all kinds of weather, and they said, let's start a church here. And so they started University Church. It was founded in 1909. The domed part of the church, the old part of the building, it's just an amazing structure. It's the first structure built west of the Mississippi after the, you'll have to look up when the Belgian World's Fair was, but it's a freestanding dome.
Oh, cool.
And they just didn't do that very often. And we're the first one that was built west of the Mississippi after that. So we've got some cool things there, but the faculty, administration, and students dedicated 20% of their income for 5 years to pay for that thing, for the building that we now enjoy. And I'm just so indebted. This part of the building, the newer part, was built in 1955-ish. The parsonage was built about that time that I live in, which is just next door. And before that, the parsonage, before the church was even built, there was a four-square, two-story house that was built. And it's gone now, of course. They tore it down, darn. We love those old houses, my wife and I. And it was, but it was a sidewalk away from the church. I mean, literally, you could hear the organ playing. It was that close. We have one of the oldest continuously operating organs in town, and we have I think it's either the first or second continuously chartered Boy Scout groups in the nation. We have Boy Scout Troop 5, and they were chartered back in 1909 with the church, and we have continuously supported been their charter, mm-hmm. their charter organization since 1909. And I think we're either number one or number two now as far as, number two, maybe number one now, as being the longest continuously chartered scout troop, I mean the church and the, mm-hmm. the scout troop in the country. So cool. So it's really cool.
Yeah.
And we have a really long relationship with them. Mm-hmm. So that's part of, you know, that's part of what we do too. So anyway, we serve Christ campus and community. Mm-hmm. We serve the poor in a number of ways. I've got a guy coming in a couple of minutes that will be helped, or we'll look at helping him with our Helping Hands Fund. Mm-hmm. We have Buck Meal that they close the cafeteria at Kansas Wesleyan Sunday afternoon. So there's no evening meal on Sunday. So we provide a meal, serve about 150 students
cool.
and others every Sunday that the school
wow.
school is in session and
yeah.
then some. So we've been doing that for about 15 years now, and it's just a really neat place.
Mm-hmm.
I serve on a lot of different committees and organizations within the general church, and
mm-hmm.
so it's you know, it's really a lot to
mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things going on here all the time.
Definitely so, sounds like it.
Got a busy place.
Yeah. I just have a couple more questions.
Sure.
How were new members recruited, and what was the process of joining for this church anyways?
For now or over the years?
I'm sure over the years it's changed quite
yeah.
a bit.
And I can tell you about now.
Okay.
What we do is we open, you know, we're open for about anyone. We encourage anyone to come in
mm-hmm.
and share the good news. It really is a grace-filled place
mm-hmm.
that we try to offer as much as we can and in as many ways as we can to help people grow in the faith.
Mm-hmm.
People come in, our voice in the community, there are six different United Methodist churches in town. Our voice, and our voice in the community is that of the campus voice.
Mm-hmm.
And so for those who are interested in that kind of life with connecting with, you know, the sports and the kids
mm-hmm.
and the music programs and the theater and the art and all that and learnings and that campus life,
mm-hmm.
we're the church to come to.
Mm-hmm.
If you're interested in another voice, there are lots of other different churches, five other churches to look at here in town. And so, it's a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's affected, it's shaped this, you know, this community.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, we've got a really good group of pastors who work closely together and are starting to work closely together.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say really closely now, but it's really cool. And I know these guys really well, and it's just been a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway.
I don't think I have any other questions. I think you've answered pretty much everything that I have.